Welcome everybody to the latest episode of Sense. I have with me someone now who's a regular guest on the show, and that is Leighton Cleverley.
Oh, hello. Hello again.
Hello.
Hopefully people won't be getting bored of what I've got to say and listening to me waffle on too much. I promise we're going to be quicker with it tonight, I promise.
That's all right. Thank you.
Man. Happy New Year to everybody who is listening as well, as we're recording this right at sort of first week of January.
Yeah, New Year, fresh start for everybody. And in this episode, what we're trying to do is just talk about some of the everyday mistakes we've made with film, probably from a beginner's point of view, maybe the questions you're thinking about or you've gone through, and then Leighton's going to try and speak from experience and help us get through them.
Yes.
Are you ready for that?
Yeah, hopefully.
So your first one, very, very simple. Some of us have struggled loading film. What are we doing wrong? What are we doing right? Well, how do we do it properly?
Right. I mean, every camera is pretty much different on this one, but there's a few things that are sort of shared amongst all types of cameras. I'm going to ignore electronic-based ones for a minute and look at the sort of manual-based ones.
Okay.
Generally, when you load the film and you pull it out of the cassette or out of, you know, your 120 spool or roll, I should say, and you put it onto the take-up spool, when you close the back and you start to advance to the first frame, the biggest indicator to look for is the rewind crank, because that should start to move. And it should, if you go through the roll, the rewind crank will move all the time. Every time you take a photo, it should advance. You know, if it doesn't at all, you know, you be very, very suspicious of what's going on.
Yeah.
The other thing is that sometimes it won't move in the first three or four pictures because it sort of like goes a bit loose in the cassette. But what you can do is, if you're a little suspicious, is you can actually turn the rewind crank a little bit and take that slack back up again. And if you start to feel resistance, then you're probably okay. If, however, you don't feel anything, be very suspicious that the camera's not loaded correctly. I mean, the other big indicator is if it's a camera you're not familiar with, is try and load it somewhere quiet, because if it doesn't go into the spool properly or clips out or flicks out, it will make a noise, but it won't be very loud. It'll probably make a tick noise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're advancing the film, you will hear a noise in the camera. You hear a sort of, you know, plastic sliding around noise,
yeah,
as the film is advancing. You don't hear any of these, then be very suspicious about what is happening inside the camera. You know, but the rewind crank is the biggest one. The modern era electronic type cameras, like, you know, like the sort of latest generation of Canons, Nikons, that sort of thing. When you put the film in and you press the back close, they usually automatically wind on. Those it should make quite a noise. You should hear a sort of plastic crinkly noise as the film's pulled through, and then it should be set at number one, and then it's ready to shoot. If none of these things happen, then and you close the back, you don't hear any other noise, and it doesn't go to frame number one, then there's obviously something has gone wrong in there. But I tend to find that those very rarely fail to go on. It's the manual cameras are much, much worse.
Mm.
And can be a lot awkward as well. Things like Leicas are awkward to load. You know, I would advise you to go and watch a video on those, because they're awkward. And you need to get used to using them. It's like a lot of things. They're easy once you're used to it. But getting used to it takes the time. So I think that pretty much covers most of the problems you can have when you're loading when you're loading film. I can't really think of anything of anything else from that.
No, I think
just making sure it's working.
Yeah, I think you're right with a visual clue.
Yeah.
Because like we've said, if you're just looking at the exposure count or 1, 2, 3 or whatever, that's not always true because film can get stuck, but your shutter still works, doesn't it, and counts. So.
It does, yes. The counter's going up, but you might not actually be doing anything.
Yeah.
It's happened to me on more than one occasion. And, the worst time is when you don't catch it. You're busy. You're on the street. You're busy. You're at a do on a photo shoot, and you just don't quite notice that it hasn't loaded properly. And you can guarantee that's the one time it goes wrong.
Yeah.
So, it's like all these things. With practice, problems become less and less and less.
Yep. And if you struggle, like you say, consult a manual.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, in this day and age, there's a lot of online. Like YouTube's a great one. Because I bet you 10 to 1, somebody on YouTube has done a video of loading your camera.
Yeah. I think what I'll do is I'll have to add a couple because there isn't many on, like, the Bronica, to be honest.
No, there probably isn't.
So it's probably a good idea for me to do a couple there.
Yes. I mean, medium format is slightly different.
It is.
A 35mm anyway, because you've got to get the arrows lined up and then pull it across. Full disclosure on that one, I don't shoot medium format. I only shoot 35mm. I'm just a 35mm shooter. So.
Yeah. No, that's cool. I think the only caveat there was my Olympus trip. It actually rewinds around the spool backwards to what you're used to.
Mm, yes, yeah.
Which is a little confusing on your first look.
Yes, yeah, when you open it up and go, okay, it works backwards.
Mm.
I mean, there are cameras that pull all the film out and then work their way back into the canister again, but, yeah, there's many and varied. Check your manual, have a look. They're not too difficult to figure out. Once you can load one camera, you can pretty much load anything because they all generally work the same.
Yeah.
Obviously with caveats there, but...
No, that's cool.
Right, anyway, shall we...
Yeah, that's fine. So,
move on that one.
The second one was what I've done a couple of times. I've rewound too far. The film's gone into the canister and I thought, ooh, is this okay to send to a lab? Or... is it any different for processing at home?
Generally, no. There's no problem with rolling everything straight back into the canister. I mean, you get a proper tool for popping the top off in a dark environment. At home, you can use a bottle opener, pull it off, get it out, and away you go. In a film lab, they have a tool that will retrieve the leader out. You can get those for at home as well. I've never used one. Never really seen the point of them. Hmm. But I don't think I've told you this, but my uncle actually was a press photographer for the Birmingham Mail, I think it was, or Birmingham Post. That's big amazing. Newspapers. Yeah. And he... was shooting 35mm and doing obviously newspaper type things.
Okay.
The advice from him was when you get the film out, obviously on 35mm, try and leave a little bit of leader pointing out at the end.
Yeah.
Or if you have a camera that leaves a leader out at the end, put a crease in the end of the leader. So pull it over and crease it. For one, it shows that it's been exposed because it's very easy if it leaves the leader out to accidentally expose a film twice.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the second thing, what I do is I put a number of creases into the number of stops that I've pushed the film because quite often I'll take 400 ISO film and I'll rate it at 1600 and then I'll push process it so it becomes pushed. Mm-hmm. So what I'll do then is when it's shot, it gets a crease in it. If it's shot at 800, it'll get another one. If it's shot at 1600, it'll get another one.
Ah.
So I pull it out and go, oh, three creases. This is being shot at 1600, so those need to be done. Oh, I shot this one at box speed, so it just needs a normal processing. Because obviously what you don't want to do is mix up how you've shot them.
Yeah.
Which I'm not going to put my hand up and say it, but everybody has screwed that up at some point.
Yeah.
Because you've just chucked it into your bag or your pocket. You said, I'll deal with it later, and you never do.
Yeah.
So it's best to just pull it out, put the creases in, and that way you don't need to write on with a pen or anything. You just know straight away what's happened. And then if you pull it out of the bag when you're looking for fresh film, you know it's been shot straight away. And, you know, that's what I tend to do. If you want to feel that electronic rewind cameras will generally, there's a setting that you can say leave a leader or take it in. Most will leave a leader out, so you can just do that. If you're in a manual camera, you know, with a rewind crank, if when you're rewinding, you can go fairly quick at the beginning, but after you've done it for a little while, when you come to the end and it pulls out of the take-up spool, you can actually feel it come out. There'll be a little bit of resistance, and then suddenly the resistance is gone. That's when you're back to just the leader out. You might need a little bit of practice just to get it, but once you've done it two or three times, you can feel that really quickly. So you can rewind fairly quick on that one. So that's probably my advice on that one.
Okay, no, that's good. Yeah. So though, what we're saying is, it doesn't really matter, to be honest.
No, not really. But you can take advantages of this. You know, if you never push your film and it's always shot at box speed or whatever, then don't worry about pulling the leader in. It really makes no difference whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, for anyone developing at home, my first few ones, I had them all the way in, which then I had to think, how do you actually get the cap off? Because I'd never done that.
Yes.
And actually,
brute force and ignorance.
Brute force is the only way that works, yeah. Leighton said that before, you can use a bottle opener. Now, I've got a modern blunt one. So let me tell you, that's pretty hard to get the end of a film canister.
They're crimped.
Yeah.
They are crimped fairly hard.
Yeah. You can use all sorts. I've actually used scissors before.
I mean, you can hack your way into
it. Yeah.
I mean, really, it's not ideal pulling film all the way back out through the curtain, you know, through the little fuzzy curtain at the end anyway, because it can scratch your film. I know people that have never had a problem. I know people that have had problems. I don't personally do it. I try to minimise, you know, problems for yourself. You don't. It's difficult enough as it is. You don't need to be giving yourself more problems.
Yeah, that's right. I think the only reason I was extra careful was I wanted to keep the film ready in case I want to bullet load my own.
Mm.
So in that case, you really need to keep your canister good, and then you have to keep a little bit of film on the end.
We'll not worry
about that for now anyway. So either way, not a massive issue. The next one. So I've got to the end of my film and I realised the film didn't wind. There's a way around this. What's your thoughts?
When you say you didn't, the film didn't wind, what do you mean?
So it got to exposure 24 and you try rewinding and it's either already fully rewound or it's partly wound. So you've only probably exposed some of your film, or actually none. It just kept wrapping itself around each other.
Okay, I've never really had too much of a problem with that, okay. But depending on whether you care about the film or not,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you've shot half of a film and you've got a problem, then there's nothing you can do in the field. You need somewhere dark.
Yeah.
You're going to have to deal with it in the dark. I had a problem with this. I was on holiday. I'd taken my Canon 30 and I had a bulk loaded film in there. I shot the film, and what I hadn't realized is in the heat where I was, the tape holding the film had come off and it had gone soft and come off.
Wow.
So, of course, all of my film is now on the take-up spool in the camera and none of it's connected to the cassette to rewind it.
No.
So I'm like, oh, I haven't got a dark room. I haven't got a changing bag with me. What am I going to do? In the end, what I did do, now this is a very useful thing, is hotel bathrooms generally don't have windows in them.
Mm-hmm.
Leave it till nighttime. Turn all the lights off in your room, close the curtains, shut the bathroom door. It will be dark enough to deal with the film. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I opened the back, took out the cassette. I very gingerly found the end of the film that was stuck in the camera, put it back onto the onto the spool in the cassette,
mm-hmm.
put it back in the camera, and fortunately, it rewound.
Right.
I managed to get away with it. Other than that, that's it. Your day's over. You need to go home and get it sorted. Sadly, you do get up to a point where there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Or you're going to end up sacrificing the role of film. It's like, unfortunately, those are the only two choices.
Yeah. So if you've already opened the back up, you're in trouble. Or if you've already realised, would you reshoot it and do double exposure, or would you just make do with what you've got?
I'd make do with what I've got. There you go. Basically, it's like that. I mean, it's one of the reasons why quite often I carry two bodies with me.
Okay.
If I have one as a problem, I pull out the spare.
Yeah.
And I carry on.
Yeah.
Again, if I'm dodging in and out of dark buildings, like in Italy, when we were there, we're on the street and it's massively sunny. In the buildings, it was really dark. So I got one body with, you know, my 400 choice ISO film of choice, pushed to 1600 for inside, and I got box speed 400 for outside. You know, again, though, you do sacrifice with the fact that you've got to carry all this gear with you. So,
yeah,
as I said, it's always compromise and swings and roundabouts. What you lose on the swings, you gain on the roundabouts. So,
That's cool. Yeah, I like that. Now, let's see if Leighton's made this mistake. I've sent off quite a few blank films for processing by the lab.
No, I haven't, because I do, with number two, it's either rolled all the way in or it's creased on the end.
Mm.
So I know what I've shot and what I haven't.
Yeah.
So that is the one, that's about one of the mistakes that I've not done, is actually processed a blank roll. The only time I processed a blank roll was when I had a shutter fail and I didn't realise.
Okay.
And I had a blank roll. Because I was like, oh, what have I done? And then I took out the roll underneath and it was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, I've got a dead shutter, which I was very annoyed about, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But that one, you minimise problems with just, you know, getting a good routine of what you're doing. You settle into a routine. I mean, the more that you do it, the more that you do film photography and you get into your own routine of doing things, then that's when you don't make where the mistakes stop.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's something I've got to work on this year. And I think because I started developing myself, it's something I've learned. So
yeah,
I think for anyone listening,
yeah,
get in good habits.
Yes. I mean, remember, there's no right or wrong method.
Yeah.
It's just do whatever works for you. As long as your images are turning out how you want them, great. Don't let anybody tell you you're doing it wrong. It's whatever. If it works for you, it works for you. I can guarantee that, well, I know this for a fact, that you work differently to me and I work differently to my friends.
Mm.
We all have our own little workflows and whatever's how it works.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. I think one of the best solutions here, because it's probably a lazy or a stupid thing I've done, I have all my films more or less in the same box, whether they've been shot or they're ready to shoot. Yeah. So now I've got a separate box, so right on the top of it, yeah, to shoot, yeah, and then another box.
Yes, what shot and what,
yeah,
shot.
That's probably dark as well, so.
Yeah, it wouldn't do it any harm.
Yeah.
Again, you know, these things, as you build up your own methods and your own organisations and your own way of doing things, you'll find that mistakes will peter out fairly quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
Right, you want to hit me with...
The next one for Dr. Layton.
The film doctor, not it.
This one I've done several times. If you've got a standard SLR, sometimes there's nowhere on the camera for you to remember what film you've put in. And of course... I've then totally forgot either when I'm shooting and then it's too late afterwards.
The majority of cameras have a meter in.
Yep.
So, I mean, your ISO on the meter should be set to what you're using.
I
minimize it because I only ever shoot 2 or 3 film stocks. So I know if it's set to 100, I'm using foam 100.
Yep.
If it's set to 400, it's probably HP5+. If it's set to 1600, it's definitely going to be HP5+. So for me, it isn't so much of a problem.
Yep.
But if you do forget what you're shooting, and I mean, the biggest problem is you forgot what you were shooting and you've shoved it in your bag and you go, did I shoot it at 1600 or did I shoot it at 400?
That's another one, yeah.
Yeah. What you can do, if you don't know what you shot it as, use stand development, because whether you shot it at 100, 400 or 1600, it's the same development.
Okay.
So you can get away with it. Obviously, that doesn't work for colour film.
Yeah.
It only works for black and white film.
Yeah.
But as I've said before, I shoot almost zero colour. Yeah. Unless I've done something funky and made my own red scale film, but that's something for a completely different conversation.
Yeah.
But yes, you can get away. If you're not sure what you shot it with, then you can use stand development and it will give you images and it may well get you out of any problems.
Mm.
But again, referring back to, you know, when you rewind your film, then you'll know what you've got when it comes out the camera, and also make notes. Carry a pen with you, and you can write on the film, you can write on the backing paper, you can write on the canister, and just make a note of what it is. Again, getting into the way of working, then that is what gets around these problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is your workflow.
Yeah.
Oh,
definitely.
That's a good word. There we go.
Yeah, yeah.
I might patent that along with Sky Blue Thinking. But yes, you know, you get into your way of doing things.
Hmm.
Most of these problems will drop off.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's we've all been there and done it and used 27 different types of film.
Hmm.
But to be honest with you, I come down to using just 2 or 3 and that's it anymore. I mean, I've got some... I mean, don't get me wrong, I get excited when there's a new film come out. I'm like, ooh, new film. Mm. But then I end up just shooting what I'm used to because I know how it works.
That's it, yeah.
I know what I can do with it. I know what I can extract out of it.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that.
But don't let that stop you experimenting. I mean, I've got a roll of Film Farina P30 downstairs.
Okay.
Which I bought in Italy not like a year ago, and I still haven't actually shot it yet. I'm saving it for a special occasion, and I have no idea why. I should just go out and shoot it.
Yeah.
So I should just go out and use it.
Yeah.
But, you know, anyway. So I think that pretty much covers that issue, I think.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add is look for an SLR that has like a little film window on the back of where the film back opens up. And there's just enough room on there to slide in the edge from your film packet. Now they're not on all really budget ones. So, like on an Olympus OM10, you don't have it. You have to buy their top of the range, like OM1-2 sort of range. But honestly, as a beginner, it saves your life. It really does.
Yes, yeah. I mean, as I said, you get used to it as you go if you use them all. I mean, some of the more modern SLRs actually have a sort of viewport that you can see the film you've got loaded.
Okay, that's good.
As well. So my Leicas have got that. My Canons have got that as well.
Ooh.
I'm trying to think. Certainly my 1V has it. My 30 does, which, in fact, I'm looking at it on the shelf. I've got to dig it out and get some batteries for that. I've got some older bodies and cheaper bodies, which I think has got it as well. So, you know, see what you've got. As I said, if you know there's a weak point, you can plan around it. It's when you're starting out and you go, ah. We've all been caught with those ah moments.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So that should give you a few ideas to get around that one.
Yeah, certainly. And it's also necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
You know, you can always do something. You know, but I mean, as I said, I'm quite practical with these things. You know, I'll build things and mess around with things.
Yeah.
Much to my wife's horror sometimes. But what are you doing? I'm going into the garage and I'm not coming out until I've invented something. Which will probably be appalling and of limited use, but
yeah,
we'll get the job done.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Right, okay. You want to throw another issue at
so,
us? Or at us, I should say. It's a conversation.
I've had this one a couple of times where a back of cameras opened.
Okay.
One of them, so first one, 5mm.
This one is a pet hate of mine. I see so many people on the internet go, oh, I opened the back of my camera.
Yep.
Okay. If you open the back of your camera, it doesn't matter. Film is actually opaque. Most of the time, you don't actually ever see your film. And the bit that you see is just the leader of the film. But that is exactly what your film looks like. If you open the back of your film and you're halfway through a shot, you will lose the shot that's over the shutter at the moment, and you will probably lose two other shots, and that's it. That's all you will lose.
Yeah.
Because the film itself is actually light tight. It's light proof. That when it's on that take-up spool at the end and it's very, very, very tightly wound, light doesn't get in. It's fine. You'll lose three shots on 35mm.
Yeah.
You might lose two or three on 120 medium format.
Yeah.
So don't panic. It's annoying. It's not the end of the world. Don't think you've got to rip the whole film off and everything's ruined. No, it isn't. You've lost three shots.
Yeah.
I've done it. I've probably done it three or four times. So don't worry about it. It's not a problem. So I see people, you know, having a fit online, and you go, no, it's fine, honestly. Because anything that's in the take-up spool is fine. In the cassette is fine. Anything at the other end is that tightly rolled, light can't get through. You're fine, honestly. So don't do it.
Mm.
You know, if you can help it, try not to do it. But it doesn't really matter that much if you do it.
Mm.
Say you'll lose three shots.
Yeah.
Try not to drop your camera as well. You're dropping your camera is not good for him.
Nah.
I mean, bearing in mind, all film cameras are probably now at least 10 years old.
Mm.
I mean, I got a friend of mine, he does drop his camera on occasion, and it really does make no difference, but try not to do it. It's what neck straps are for. You know, you should always have a strap, either a wrist strap or a neck strap around your neck. Obviously, it's a good place to put your neck strap around your neck. sorry, listeners. Just to stop gravity, because, I mean, gravity is a cruel mistress.
Yeah.
You know, it is not going to do your... It's not going to do your camera any favours.
Yeah.
It really isn't.
It's not very big,
you know. And worst case scenario, they go crunch, they don't bounce. So you could risk actually breaking something. So, I mean, what I've got on my... I know I've referred to them before. On my Leicas, I've got one with a neck strap and one with a wrist strap.
Mm-hmm.
Because the wrist strap is fantastic, but when you've got this thing sliding about on your wrist and you're trying to do other things, you know, you're sort of killing pedestrians with it, because it's like a... It's like, weighs like a house brick.
Okay.
That's where the advantage of the neck strap comes on. But the neck strap, when you're doing street photography, is a pain because you've got a massive camera sat in the middle of your chest.
Mm.
So, you know, you show up from a mile and a half away. Mm. So, you know, the swings and roundabouts. Not only that, it's sometimes if, like at this time of the year, I actually do go and do a little bit of landscape stuff. And if it's a bit windy and you've got a neck strap, it's like a sail. It's making your camera vibrate on the tripod and it's pulling your camera over. I mean, I'm very partial to getting on the beach with my cameras as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, doubly, you don't want to drop your camera into sand.
Oh, no.
You know, or into salt water.
Mm.
There's a big fallacy that weather-sealed cameras are waterproof. No, they're not really waterproof. The way I tend to do it is, if I'm not happy with the rain, neither is my camera.
Yeah.
So, living in Scotland, that happens quite often. So, you know, you try not to get things too wet. I mean, the other thing is as well, always remember, if you're out shooting and it's cold, don't come and bring your camera out in a warm house. The first thing it will do is condensate, which I think I might have mentioned this before, but I can't remember if I have. That does the electronics no good whatsoever.
Yeah.
If your camera has electrics. If your camera doesn't have electrics, it doesn't do springs and gears and stuff like that, a lot of good. I mean, they are precision instruments at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, that's not too bad there. So I think that covers everything on that topic from my point of view.
You forgot one other strap.
Oh, did I?
This is because you don't shoot medium format.
Right.
Shoulder strap.
for the heavy beats.
Yeah, so when I've been out on the street with a Bronica, I'll tell you what, a shoulder strap is fabulous because you can move the camera up and down the strap from your waist to your level, like lying in.
Yeah,
it's secured via the tripod mount. So
it's great.
However, one time I walked up the infamous steep hill in Lincoln, and the camera caught the railing and the film back fell off.
Oh, okay. I could see that would be annoying.
Yeah, so that was a quick, took my jacket off really fast, covered it up.
Yes, yeah, so you'd have burnt that. That shot.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're talking of probably two
shots,
to be honest. Yeah,
yeah. That's more annoying. That's more of annoying of an annoyance. So
yeah.
So no, that's pure extra careful there.
Yeah, it's just a pure accident. These things happen.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the last one's not so much a mistake, but do you think it's important to record settings when shooting? Because obviously you don't have anything to remember by otherwise.
Yeah, if you're shooting roll film, like, you know, anything that's on a roll, so you shoot, you know, medium format, you shoot 35mm, then no, because what real difference does it make? Yeah. I see a lot of people online saying, oh, how did you shoot this? What aperture did you use? It's all pretty subjective, and, you know, if you put in the same settings as them, you are not going to get the same results. It doesn't work like that. It comes down to metering, setting your light, and then doing it. With 35mm, I don't worry about it. The bigger the format, the more you need to worry about it. So, you know, even on medium format, you're starting to making almost, you know, every shot is done with the different settings. But when it comes to large format photography, then you're probably going to start using the zone system, and you're going to have to write everything down, because you are going to develop based on how you shot that particular slice of film. Yeah. When you're shooting roll film, it's pretty much all over the place, because everyone is different and there's 36 of them. So your meter will generally put everything in the same place. So you develop that entire roll and that's what you got. But with a per shot, you know, a settings that you can set individually per frame, then you really need to write it down. You need to write that stuff down.
Okay.
On there, but, you know, I have to admit, do I write anything down? No, I don't. So I don't really care whether it was shot at 1/150th or 1/250th. I don't really care. Yeah, you know,
I'm same as you. Yeah, I think it's good to be away from the digital side of knowing your settings in some ways.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you take a meter, you know, meter it yourself with the Sony 16 rule or whatever, as long as that shot is correct. When you, correct for the ISO, when you develop it, it's developed. You know, it's as simple as. So, but as I said, don't, just because that's what I do, you know, don't be constrained by what I do. If you want to make copious notes when you're out shooting, carry on. You know, it's entirely up to you. There's no, as I said before earlier on, there's no right way, there's no wrong way. There's only guides how people work. So that's really all I've got to say on that one.
No, that's cool. Yeah. Yeah, it was only a quick thing, really, though. So I think that sort of really concludes, like, the area around cameras and films. Yeah. And I think if we move on to, obviously, some of you have a lot of experience with, and that's the development. So when I first started, obviously, I pestered you a few times with some simple questions. And it's hard when you first start, and not all of us have on workshops or got people around us.
Well, I never did. Everything that I figured out, I figured it out myself.
Yeah, which is amazing.
With this, it's, mind you, my background, I've got a degree in applied physics. I treated it like I would treat any experiment or anything like that. I hasten to add that I don't use it in my daily job. But keep it standard. Keep it simple. Only change one thing at a time to find out what effect it has. So you go online, go do some research. I mean, I just went into a shop and went, oh, that's a developer. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know how it worked. I just grabbed it and it said, do this for five minutes, see what happens.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I got images. They weren't fantastic, but I got them. You know, so at the which point then you go out and decide what works for you. It's a journey, you know, to get out there. So, right, do you want to hit me with some specifics?
Yeah, so when you're first starting out, you've got your film. How do you know how much time you need to develop for, how much mix you need, the dilution?
Fair enough. The amount of fluid that you need generally is written on your dev tank. So I've got a Patterson Super System 4 tank.
Yeah.
And on the bottom, it says you need so many milliliters for one film. You need so many milliliters for, you know, two films. I rounded it up. I use 600 milliliters. I use 300 for one film, 600 for two films. This is 35 millimeter. You will need to read the tank. It will tell you all underneath what you need to know, or somewhere on the tank it will tell you. So once you've known that, that's fine. The next thing is going to be how much developer that you're going to need. I'm just going to say a very simple three bath system. So you develop it, you stop it, you fix it, you wash it, you hang it up to dry. Nothing fancy here. So there is a great there's two ways of doing it. When you buy film, not bulk load, a proper bit of film, a proper, you know, roll of film, the box it comes in on the inside has the instructions to develop it in a very simple way. It will give you a list of developers, it will give you a list of times and a list of temperatures. So the easiest thing you can do is pick one of those at the dilution it tells you, at the time it gives you. It will give you a medium contrast negative.
Yep.
Secondly, if you look online and do a Google search for massive dev chart, that's massive space dev space chart, it will give you a huge listing of about every film that you can imagine and every developer that you can imagine. It will then, you look up what film you're using, what you're using, and it will give you a load of recipes. You can just pick from there and do that. Mixing is very easy on there. I think we've already gone into that on a previous podcast. And that's it. That's all you need. Now, again, don't be afraid to experiment. Changing times and temperatures and developer concentrations will change how they work. For example, I love Rodinal. It's my favorite. I use it for pretty much everything. And the less that you use, so the less that's actually in the mix, you start getting what we call a compensation effect. So say your shadows are very, you know, highly, say it was a very bright scene and the shadows are very dark.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're using not a lot of developer, those won't get developed quite as much because it will exhaust the developer in those areas.
Mm.
Whereas the highlights will develop as normal because there's less silver grains there to be developed.
Okay.
So, because remember, it works opposite because it's negative. Because it's negative. And yeah, makes sense. You start getting these effects. There's a lot of stuff written down about it. But really, really easy, if you want to pretty much guarantee images, if you take HP5 Plus and give it 11 minutes at 1+50 in Rodinal. That will be in a tank of 600 milliliters. That will be 12 milliliters of developer of Rodinal. Add enough water to go up to 600 millilitres, so it would be 588, if my mm-hmm. maths is correct. At this time of night, you pay your money, you take your chance. Put your film in there for 11 minutes. For the first 30 seconds, slowly turn it upside down and the right way back up again. Every minute, turn the tank upside down twice over about a 10-second period. You will have images. They might not be perfect for you, but you will have images. The problem is until you start seeing what you're producing, you can't tailor what you do. Now, for me, that 11 minutes at 1 plus 50 is great. I'm very happy with the results. If I haven't got enough contrast, I can add some in afterwards when I make the print. But generally, I'm happy with that. So, that will give you a very easy... That'll give you a very easy thing. Developing black and white is easy. As I said before, it's actually very difficult. I mean, if you don't watch your temperature that much, even if it's 2 or 3 degrees out, it won't really make that much of a difference. It's more susceptible to being cold than hot. So you don't really want it to be too cold. But if it's 21, if it's 20 degrees and you do it at 21 over 11 minutes, I bet you can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you give it, say, make it 25, you probably would do, but... Yeah, again, it's whatever works for you. What I do is I have one thermometer, which everything I do is based off, because that was the very first thermometer I used. So everything I have is calibrated against that thermometer. So that thermometer says 20. It probably isn't 20, but that's where I went from. So, it's one of those things where it's like you would do science in school. Keep it simple, keep it standard, make life easy for yourself. If you change three things and you produce brilliant, brilliant negatives, or they're absolutely shocking, you don't know what actually caused that. Change one thing at a time. So, you think, oh, I don't like the look of these negatives. They're too contrasty. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to reduce my time. I'm going to give them less time. I'm going to give them... Give them 10% less. So what happens if I knock 1.5 minutes off? I don't like them. What happens if I add 1.5 minutes on? They look very thin and horrible. I want to add time. Because remember, your camera won't meter the same way my camera does.
Yeah, that's right.
There's lots of variations. You can only, the first few times you do it, you'll be in the middle. You'll be in the where everybody else is kind of at. But then you will tailor yourself down until you find a sweet spot for your gear, your film, your developer, and do it that way.
Yeah.
So that's really pretty much how do you know? It's experimentation. Look up something, then experiment and see how it works for you.
Yeah.
There's others there to go with.
Yeah, I think we'll put a link to Massive Dev Checks. I think. Yeah. Well, 90% of people must use that.
I would have thought so. There are actually other ones as well, but that's the one I tend to look up. If somebody asked me a question the other day and I went and had a look on Massive Dev Chart, because what they were telling me didn't sound right, but I wasn't that familiar with the film and developer combination. So I'm like, well, I'll go and have a look and see what that says.
Yeah.
And then I'll come back. My gut feeling says that's wrong. However, just because I think it doesn't necessarily make it true. And you will find a lot of people have a lot of opinions where they claim it's right, but it's really what they think, or it's a gut feeling. It's not necessarily empirical fact.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a lot of that. Yeah,
there's a lot of people talk a very good photograph.
But.
As I said, as long as you're having fun, that's the main thing.
Yeah. Well, no, that's fine. So I'll put a link to that on. So then if we flip this on its head, how do you know when your chemicals are exhausted?
Right. you're going to like this one. So I hope everybody has a strong stomach who's listening. Developer is very much like your hydration levels. Mm-hmm. You know when you go to the toilet and you go for, shall we say, a number one, mm-hmm. and you look down, it looks like apple juice.
Yep.
Yeah, you don't want to see that. You don't want to be producing that, and your chemistry shouldn't look like that. If it's like that, it's had it. It should be a very nice light straw colour. This is a generalisation. When it comes to paper developer, definitely it oxidises very quickly, and the oxidising makes it go dark. So, like you, if you're doing that, you know that you're not right. Neither is the developer.
Yeah, that's got that.
Stop bath comes with an indicator in it, which goes purple when it's exhausted. I always use indicator stop bath. There's a lot of talk about stop baths, whether you should use them, whether you're not, shouldn't use them. I always do. I always use them because it saves your fixer. You don't have to, but I do. Your stop bath and your fixer on the side of the bottle will tell you how many square meters it will process.
Okay.
So read down the back of the bottle. It will tell you how you need to mix it, and it will tell you how many square meters. I think I use Tetnal Superfix Plus. So plug for Tetnal there. Probably more of that later.
Ka-ching, ka-ching.
I wish. and that, well, I think it does something like I calculated it out that I can fix like 40 or 50 sheets of 8x10 in it.
Oh, okay.
And quite a lot of film. Again, read the instructions on your bottles. Read them twice. The other thing is I tend to find after using them, putting them in the dark room, they tend to get floating bits in them. Like I tend to chuck my chemistry when I see eyelashes floating in it, or it's about 8 to 12 weeks old. I don't leave it massively. It's fine and it works fine, but it's starting to get a bit old at that point. So, you know, it's time to get rid of it. Although I was going to mention, developers like Ilfasol 3 and those ilk go off very quickly. They only last about 3 months when they're open.
Which I think
you might have found that out. Rodinol and HC110 do change colour, but they work fine. So don't be fooled on those ones. Yes, those do go dark, but they still work. I mean, they opened a bottle of Rodinol from 1977 and it still works fine. So honestly, it is fine. I mean, Rodinol is everything proof. I mean, it is the only developer you will ever need.
It'd be better if I'd have started with that in a way.
Yes, yeah. You can't sing the praises of Rodinol. You might see it called Rodinol. You might see it's called RO9. You might see it's called Adnol or Adnol. It's all Rodinol. Go and use it. You will not be disappointed. You know, it keeps forever. It will do everything you will ever need.
Yeah.
So, as I said, it's a bit like a holy war when it comes to developers. You know, from what I'm saying, I'm preaching Rodinol, and you'll find the D76 hordes will come with their pitchforks after me. Yeah, yeah. So
and the Ilford HC one.
And the Ilford HC people will be running after the Fomadon people. And again, find what works for you. If you don't like what one produces, there's another one that will do something else.
Yeah. Yeah, you've just got to do that. And you've got to listen to some people. So like you're saying, Ilfasol doesn't last. So if you don't do much development, it's not for you, trust me.
No, because you won't know, you'll make a mistake, and you will find you'll get nothing on your... thing. It's gone. It's not working. It's died.
And to be honest, when I opened mine up last time, it was that bad. It looked like glue.
Yeah, yeah.
It was literally like slop instead of just, you know.
Yes. I mean, I'm sure that in another podcast we'll discuss how to actually extend the life of these things, because you can extend the life of them without spending too much money, but that's probably something for another podcast.
Maybe when people are a bit more advanced,
Okay.
That's cool. I know I had this one the other day. When I was loading my film onto a reel in a dark area, I've got into a good habit where I use scissors to cut both ends, so it's like a V.
Yes, to help it go into the reel. Yeah.
But once I'd started on the reel, I actually found it cut it somehow.
I will come back to that. If you're loading a reel and it goes horribly wrong, pull out all the film off the reel and start again. Just forget it. The other problem is what quite a lot of people do is you get chemistry building up on the reels. Even though you clean the reel, you know, after you pull everything apart, you should.
So you've already developed one.
Yeah. What I do is I take so many films. Generally, what I do is when it starts becoming awkward to load and it doesn't feel very smooth going on the reel, I'll take the reel and I will give it a good scrubbing with an old toothbrush and really work into the channels and get any chemistry out that's holding in there, because you just do. You get it in. Photo flow or wetting agent is terrible for it. So a lot of it comes off, but you end up with a bit of a coating, and just get an old toothbrush. I think I just use a bit of washing up liquid and give it a really, really good scrubbing. I mean, a good scrubbing, and then give it a really good rinse and a clean, because you obviously don't want any washing up liquid on there. You'll be amazed how clean they come. They're probably gone a bit yellow, and you'll find they'll come up white again, and they're ready to go. Okay. You can use warm water, hot water. The reels are designed to work up to about 50 or 60 degrees. So the plastic will take it no problem. And make sure the ball bearings are clean and easy to move around as well, because they help with the ratcheting of the film.
Yeah.
But other than that, if it feels like it's gone wrong, horribly wrong on the reel, you've got no choice but to do it again. So have fun with that.
So if you've got a cut in the film, though, you're probably going to have the same issue, aren't you?
You're probably going to have a little bit of the same issue. You're just going to have to take it slow and easy. Sometimes I find, because the plastic reels are designed to come apart, so there's a little bit of play in them. When you load it, try and pull them apart slightly. It'll make everything just a little bit wider, and you'll find that it will ratchet on a little bit easier. But it comes down to slow and careful. Even if there's a slight cut in the film, you'll get it on. You will get it on. You'll just have to be careful with it. Too much pressure when it's jammed and it'll come out of the reel, and that's it. You'll have to start again. It will not go back on again.
Okay. So could you split your film?
You could do, but you'll probably cut it halfway in a,
You're not going to be able to see it, are you?
Yeah, you're not going to know where you've cut it. The other thing is, you can't really load two halves of a film on a single reel. I know people do it with medium format, but unless you've got a specific reel that'll do it, Jobo do a reel that does this, you're going to need to use two separate reels to do it. So just be very, very gentle with everything and try and... being gentle and not ham-fisted will get you out of a lot of situations.
No, that's fine. Do you think you need a light, tight room or a dark bag?
I have done it under the quilt. Changing films. Sorry about that. You don't necessarily need a dark room or a dark bag. It's just they make life easy. Dark bag is portable. You can chuck it in the car and take it with you.
Mm.
So it gives you a little bit of flexibility for doing other things. But no, as long as it is completely light tight, you can do whatever. It's really important when you're using film that it's light tight. Film is so sensitive. Even if you can see a little bit of light, it will fog your film. It will fog. It is that bad.
Yeah.
So, but no, you can use any light tight source, you know. But warn family if you're going to do it somewhere that's dark and you're also hidden in a wardrobe.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want somebody coming along going, "Oh, what are you doing in there?"
Yeah.
You know, you're in trouble. But of course, once you've loaded the film into the tank, you can do it in the daylight anyway because the tank is light tight. So that the only time you need to be light tight is out the canister into the development tank. At that point, once you've done the development, once the developer's gone in, that's it. You can expose it to light then. So you're okay. But obviously, if you've got it in the developer and you expose it to light, you'll end up with black negatives. So you need to obviously have drained it. Ideally, sometimes when I get to the fixing stage, I will fix it for maybe a minute and I may have a look what's going on if I've got something I want to have a look at. But generally, all right, I don't open the tank until everything's washed. Once it's washed and it's had the wetting agent on it, then it's out the tank.
Yeah. No, that's cool. I like your point. It's like you read my mind. So for anyone listening, I do my loading in front of a fridge. And it sounds stupid, but basically it's a very, very small room. There's no window and the door's that tight because of the flooring.
Mm.
When it's shut, there is the smallest amount of light along the bottom of the door. So I take my jumper off or my hoodie
and
then I still turn my back anyway.
Yeah. Look at these posh people with a room for their fridge.
And that's all it holds. That's the only thing that's big enough. So I can do this within a couple of meters of my sink.
Yeah, are you ready to go?
Yeah, and there's a door. So, and then I will switch the light off in the kitchen as well.
Mm.
That helps nothing come through. But someone, of course, did last week when I was loading film. And I saw a little bit of light and I was like, oh, well, too late now.
Yeah, basically.
Minuscule.
Yeah.
It didn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, when all said and done, just carry on.
Yeah.
You know, it's difficult to ruin things. I mean, film and film photography is a very, very well-established technology. We've been doing it for, you know, two centuries. You know, it's down pat. So mostly things don't get ruined now.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. The film's really good.
Yeah.
What about using gloves?
I never use gloves.
Okay.
Never, ever use gloves. But then again, I don't go around touching anything and I have negative cleaner. If I do accidentally touch something, I give it a clean with a negative and get the finger mark off. But just hold the film by the edges. And that's it. You know, you use your eyes to look, not your fingers.
Yeah.
So, no, I've never ever used gloves. I've never felt the need. Maybe with larger formats I would.
Yeah.
Say if I was shooting 8x10s, maybe I would. But I know somebody here, he shoots 8x10s on 11x14s. He never uses gloves.
Oh, okay.
So just don't touch them.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
What about during development?
When you're developing your negatives and you've got them in water, and this is particularly important on stand development, it will soften the emulsion. You definitely don't want to be touching. You don't want your fingers anywhere near it. You will ruin your film very easily if you touch it while it's wet.
Hmm.
So you don't want to drop it. You don't want to bash it up the wall. You don't want to do anything with it. The longer that it's in the developer, the longer it's in water, so as longer it's in the process, the worse it becomes. So with stand development, I mean, it almost goes like mush. So if you touch it, you will mark it. You know, 10, 15 minutes, normal, you know, quick wash and blow dry. You're not too bad. But, yeah, you don't want your fingers anywhere near it. Hold film by the edges. That's what it's designed for.
Okay, no, that's cool. One of the things I discovered after doing a bit of development recently was 120 film especially had no labels.
Yes, so you have no idea what your film is.
Yeah.
Now, from the 35mm point of view, as he grabs a sheet of negatives in front of him, it's generally written on it what it is. So it's very easy to go, ah, right, okay, this is whatever, because it's written on the negative. What I do is when I sheet the negatives, I write a little note that goes in at the bottom of the negative carrier of the negative sheet, so I know what's in there.
Yeah.
FOMA is bad for this. FOMA never writes anything down on bulk-loaded 35mm. So you don't know what you're looking at. So it's doubly important to make notes of these things. With the 120, then I'm afraid you're on your own with that one. That is a pain when you don't know. But
I think what you were saying before though is this is where documentation can be handy. Or basically just write a little note. So you could get a little bit of piece of paper and put it at the bottom of your film clip while it's drying, or save your film box if it comes in a box and attach it there or near where you're drying it, or just write down. You've just got to be a little bit more organized. Now, from someone with my experience of shooting a lot of weird films, they could be labeled incorrectly as well.
Yes.
So I obviously shot a little bit of washy film recently, which is rebadged from whatever films he had. So they're not labeled right. There is nothing on the negative itself. They don't always come in boxes, so you've got to be very, very careful and be writing stuff down, to be honest.
Yes, yeah, that I was going to say, that's workflow on your your particular how you work. I mean, I know pretty much anything I lay my hands on is only going to probably be one of three films, so if I'm not sure. If I put it on the enlarger and I have a look at the grain structure, I can probably tell you what it is, because HP5 Plus will have larger grains than, say, FP4 Plus or FOMA 100. And I know it's only going to be one of those films. So I'm not too bad. I mean, I do have some other things, you know, hanging about, but I know, you know, I've got a note written on, so I know what they are. So when the person comes up and says, oh, do you shoot this one? I'm like, ah, that was Oriental Seagull or some other bizarre film that I am to pick up. But I generally tend to stay away from bizarre films and I shoot what I know. I know it's not as exciting, but you get better results.
Yeah. No. I totally understand. Not everyone's like me, and I think being more like what you're doing is far more sensible. I'm just not sensible.
you'll settle into it. As I said, because what I'm doing doesn't necessarily mean I do it 100% of the time. And it also doesn't mean that you have to do it as well. So,
I want to be like what you're saying is, because I don't want to ruin any films. I don't want any silly weird developments coming out or weird things with my negatives. I want consistency. So I improve my workflow or I change it. And like you say, if maybe I only shoot one film 90% of the time, and shoots different 10% of the time, I'll be fine.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
I think it's just because I've got overwhelmed by people I've podcasted with and people introducing me to new stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I want to try that.
Yes. You do. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. I mean, at the end of the day, just go and enjoy, you know, have fun. Have fun with it. There's a lot going on here. You know, there's such a lot going on with film photography. There's so many choices to make. You know, it's a lot more, it's very flexible, but that with flexibility becomes that problem of there's too many choices.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, you've got to be careful, because if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem starts becoming a nail. You know, there's that on the flip side as well. So there you go. No. You weren't expecting some good sayings there. There we go.
No, that's cool. Right.
Hashtag looks like a hammer.
Yeah, definitely. I think that covers our development side.
Okay.
So I think finally, to look at the printing elements, let's use some similar examples. How do you know when your paper is too old, or if you've been handed some old paper?
What I would do is, the first thing I would do is get in the dark room with the safe light on, doing all the normal things, pull a sheet out. Then I would put the rest of them away. I would turn the lights on and I would expose it for about 30 or 40 seconds to ambient light.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would develop it and see what it goes like, because it should go pitch black. If it goes grey or there's any marks on it or anything like that. I had some paper a while back and it was postcard paper. And, you know, it was 6x4 and actually had the bits at the back for a postcard.
Yeah.
And it had gone completely through and ruined the paper. Because when I put it in the developer, the first thing it did was show straight through.
All right.
I mean, it showed straight through on the... As soon as it went in developer, it showed. And then it went pitch black, so that was okay. But you couldn't make a print from it because it showed that coming through. That's the other thing, is once you ascertain it can go black, then do a print with it and see what the print looks like. If I'm brutally honest and you're starting out, the worst thing is having out-of-date paper, because you don't know if it's you or you don't know it's the paper.
Yep.
Go and buy new paper and start with everything afresh. This comes back to the keep everything standard and then you know what's causing the problem. Because a brand new pack of Ilford or Kentmere paper won't have a problem.
Yeah.
Fresh developer won't have a problem. Fresh stop bath won't have a problem. Fresh developer won't have a fixer won't have a problem. Run it through there, and then you know what's causing the problem. You know, if you've got old paper and your results are up and down, then it's probably the paper that's the problem.
Hmm.
But you won't know it because you don't have that pool of experience. I mean, I've got some old out-of-date paper here, and it's fine, but I don't really trust it because I don't know whether I'm going to get consistent results from it. I'd much rather have new paper and I know it works.
Hmm.
So you end up with all these, not problems, but you can help to sort of minimise it. But don't throw the old paper away. Because it might actually be okay. Just sit it on a shelf and then come back to it when you feel you're able to. And then you'll know within the first 5 sheets whether the box is scrap. If it's scrap, chuck it in the bin.
Yeah. No, that's okay. Yeah, some good points. Is it a problem to actually touch your paper with your hands? Because I'm thinking...
If you touch your paper and you've got chemistry on your hands, yeah, you'll ruin it, because it'll either develop it early or it'll leave finger marks, or if you've got fixer on there, it'll actually take the the silver gelatin will be off. So what to do is to have tongs. Always use tongs. In fact, I was having this discussion with my film photography group up here, because there's quite a few of us, and we've got a Facebook messenger group, and we're saying about tongs, and I'm like, get tongs. You don't want to be putting your hands in chemistry. And there's a guy on there that said he used to put his hands in there and he had terrible skin problems. And it took ages to get rid of them after, because he was putting his hands in chemistry, where you do not want to be putting your hands in it. And then you've got toners like selenium and heavy metal toners. You definitely don't want those on your skin, because you'll absorb the metal through them. Admittedly, selenium toner doesn't have that much in there, but I'd be more worried about the ammonia it's kept in. However, you know, you still don't want to be doing this. You know, you're far, far better off just go and get tongs and don't touch it. And then your hands never get wet with chemicals and you never have a problem. It's happened a couple of times to me where I've not been looking what I'm doing and I've ended up with a wet hand. And you go, ah. So I always keep towels and plenty of towels handy in the dark room. That I can just grab a towel, wash my hands, towel my hands off, and I'm nice and dry and ready to go.
Yeah, so, that's a good tip.
Yes. Yeah. And you can use old tea towels. It's great. Go and grab a load of tea towels and then go and buy your significant other a load of new tea towels. Mm-hmm. They get something nice and you've got tea towels.
Yeah. I'll do what we do. Because we're going through clothes, because the daughters are growing, you can just use the old clothes.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, which is quite handy.
That's a good idea. Yeah, it's a good idea.
So I've got a dressing gown at the minute from my youngest, because she's too big for it now. So
yeah, so you'll now rip it up into rags and away you go. No, it's perfect. That's a really good idea.
But
really
don't just have kids for that reason.
Sorry, say that again?
Don't just have kids for that reason, though. That's a good
reason. No, too right.
One thing we discussed was, do you have to be gentle moving your print from the developer tray to the stop to the fixer?
I'm reasonably gentle. I mean, you've got to grab it so it doesn't fall. You know, you've got to hold it hard enough that it doesn't slip out and fall on the floor, or doesn't fall off into one bath and another bath. But, you know, you've not got to treat it like, you know, it's WWE. Yeah. And bash it around and beat it to death. You know, it's not UFC in there.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's grip it hard enough, that's fine. I mean, I'm reasonable with it. You know, you don't want it falling out the tongs. So you've got to be hard enough. And believe me, at some point you will drop it.
I've done
because
that.
You just don't hold it quite hard enough. But yeah. You soon get into it. I mean, I like to say the don't be ham-fisted approach. So, be reasonable with it, but don't be ham-fisted. I hope everybody understands what ham-fisted means. You know, don't be clumsy and stupid, which I am quite often. But, you know, just be, as you do it, you'll get more skills. You'll know how hard you need to hold things. You know, resin-coated paper is a lot easier to handle than fibre-based. See, I can remember it's fibre-based paper now. Because last time I was on, I couldn't remember. It's really embarrassing. So, you know, just doing it will get you the skills. So, you know, I don't think I'm particularly rough, but I don't think I'm, you know, I don't treat it like I'm walking on eggshells.
Yeah, okay. That's fair enough. Can you tell when you've not washed your prints correctly?
Only usually when they start going yellow or fading or get stains.
Right.
If you look in the box of paper, there should be instructions in the box.
Mm-hmm.
Read the instructions. It will tell you that I think resin-coated paper needs about 5 to 10 minutes something like that. So I generally tend to give it 15 minutes because it's based on how well you're washing it and how cold the water is.
Okay.
Because the, you know, the how it works to get the chemistry out of it, it works on diffusion. It basically diffuses out of the paper into the water. So you want to make sure that it's well agitated, so you've got the highest gradient possible, and chemistry is heavier than water, so it will sink to the bottom. I have a print washer. Not sure how good it is because the thing's many years old and is pretty much at the end of its life. Still works, but it's pretty much at the end of its life. And I always give it a few minutes more to make sure. I've never had a problem with it. So, but your mileage may vary on that one. Fiber-based paper needs a lot of washing. I actually use some Hyperclear with it as well, which is a sodium sulfite solution. So the sodium thiosulfate in the fixer really doesn't like water very much, so it doesn't really want to move out from where it is. Whereas sodium sulfite will actually displace the sodium thiosulfate, and that loves water, so it loves to wash out. So it aids the speeding up of washing. That's a very quick overview. Obviously, there's a lot more complicated stuff going on there, so I don't want to seem like I'm patronising anybody, but, you know, so I tend to do that because I like to minimise the amount of water I'm using as much as I possibly can. But I still want to make sure my prints are really, really, really well washed. So usually you find out if you haven't washed the fixer out, when you come to do some selenium toning and everything turns yellow because it's not washed enough. I'm going to shamelessly plug... Can I shamelessly plug myself?
Of course you can.
Is that horrible? I'm sorry, this is a shameless plug.
No.
I was having a conversation on Instagram, and I was speaking to Technol in Europe, the head office, and I ended up sending some prints over to them, and I was featured on the Instagram feed. So thank you. That's me pushing myself slightly there. My Instagram feed will probably be at the bottom of the podcast in the description. And one of the prints I sent was a fiber-based print, and it was very slightly selenium-toned. And that was how I knew that it was washed right, because I was thinking when I selenium-tone it, if there's a problem, I'm going to find out in the next 2 minutes.
Okay.
When there's a problem. But there wasn't, so I must have washed it okay. You can actually get kits that will tell you if you've washed it. But I've never used them. I've just given it more washing than recommended, and it's been okay.
Makes sense.
I think if I had a lot of problems with it, then I might be more inclined to go for it. But generally, I haven't had a problem. He says, touching. Well, I'm looking around for something wood, and this IKEA desk I've got, I don't think it's. It might have seen a tree once, but I think it probably walked past it. So, so yes, I have an IKEA desk in my office, which I think you saw when you visited, which wasn't very exciting. It's mostly made of monitors at the moment, but I don't think that's overly important for the podcast.
lots of nice things in his room, lots of books, lots of prints.
In fact, now it looks like a bomb's gone off in it because Christmas happened.
Okay, yeah.
So you saw it when it was under control. Now it's a riot going on in here. I need to actually get in here and sort it out. But that my domestic issues are not the focus of this podcast.
Honest.
I'm not being judged.
So you've said a little bit there about the colours that can change. What if you got little blobs and stains on your prints when you finish?
Well, when you say blobs and stains, do you mean like dust marks?
No, bigger.
Or bigger?
Yeah, so
might be inclined to chuck it back in and give it another fix just in case.
Okay.
But if you've got, I mean, a fixer fixes a lot of problems. I mean, if you've got stains or anything like that, fixer might well take them back out again if it's caused by there's chemicals hanging around in there or there's something not right. Again, it depends where these are coming from. I mean, if you've touched your finger to it with chemicals on, you probably know you're not going to save it.
Right.
If the paper's iffy, you're not going to save it. You know, there's the best will in the world. You know, there's nothing you can do. It comes down again to the paper. I mean, I've had paper stored in a loft with the sun hitting it, and it's been fine. I've had stuff that I've stored perfectly, and it's been no good. So it seems to be a hit and miss. That's why I'd kind of advocate new paper, because you know 10 to 1 it's going to work.
Yeah.
You know, it just gets rid of one potential issue. I mean, that's not saying that the paper you have is an issue, but if you suddenly start getting random things happening, you have to ask yourself, why are these random things happening? Is there something on my negative? Is there something in my enlarger? You know, has my enlarger bulb got a problem? Because I had to replace the enlarger bulb in my enlarger last year. I got them from AG Photographic in Birmingham. I am not affiliated, by the way. This is not a paid promotion. They just happened to have what I wanted, and they sent it up. So, not for free, obviously. It costs money. So, you know, there's a lot of things that if something goes wrong, you need to kind of figure out what part of the process it went wrong in.
Yeah, but like you're saying,
sometimes is easier said than done.
Yeah, and if you've already stained it,
it's already stained. It's gone. I mean, if every time you do a print and you get the same mark, it's either going to be the negative or the paper.
Yeah.
If it changes and things are not looking right and it changes, it's probably not the negative. It could be, you know, as I said, an outside chance, an enlarger bulb, which has got a problem. But you'll know about that pretty quick because it will blow or it will. The enlarger bulb that I had in my enlarger, the backing had started to come off it.
Oh.
And I'm starting to get like sparkles everywhere.
Oh.
And I'm like, well, what's happening here? And I took it apart and went, oh, no.
Right.
So I was straight out in an air duster later. You know, it's then needing a new bulb and a clean out, and some of the electric contacts didn't look too clever, so I cleaned those up.
That's okay. Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? That you can have these weird issues. So even, you know, someone with experience like yourself, you come across things for the first time. We're all in the same position.
Yeah, exactly. But when something happens, then you've got to say, right.
Yes.
You've got to go and analyse where the problem's coming
from.
Yeah. So I think... No, that's, as I said, that's sometimes easier said than
done. Yeah, of course it is, yeah. Because it takes a while to probably get an understanding of, like I say, when you're developing and printing, which bit does what. So if you have a problem on the second part, the third part, did the first part cause it? Did the second part cause it? Or some external?
Yes, yeah.
I think you do. You will build up a knowledge, won't you?
That's it. Yeah, exactly. And as Mr. Spock says, when you've removed, you know, every other problem, whatever's left, no matter how odd, is the problem you're having. So yes, I am a fan of Star Trek. I do not dress up. I just say that I do not dress up. But
that's fair.
But the problem becomes in being logical, analysing where you want to where you are and where you need to be.
Yeah, I think if we could summarise these three sections of cameras, development and printing, I think the first thing is, yeah, be logical and think about either what's gone wrong or what steps you went through. And then the second part of that is get a good workflow.
Yeah.
And I think your suggestions will help you, especially at the beginning. So buy fresh chemicals, buy fresh paper, and be consistent with film.
Yes. But also remember to go and have fun.
Exactly, yeah. So just be consistent about some of it, because it's a bit of science at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Well, that's what I try to do, is put a bit of a... sort of try to be scientific in my approach.
Yeah, it's methodical as well.
Yes.
With it. And if it isn't, you'll get different results. And that's ace if you walk onto it. But I think until you've had a go a little bit yourself, you won't know. But as far as the camera side's concerned, don't ever worry. We've all been through these mistakes. There's plenty of people out there that'll listen to you. And obviously we will, you know.
Yes.
I'm going to try and pass that on to others.
Yes, correct. I mean, that's the other thing, is ask for help. I mean, there's so many resources now online that most questions have been asked or answered, you know. And as I say, when you ask for help, just look, sometimes think about some of the things that come back, because some people could be very experienced, could be very enthusiastic, but not very experienced.
Yeah.
With things, so, but I'm sure that if people have got a problem, they ask a question, it will get solved very quickly. Yeah.
And I think you shouldn't be too scared if you've had bad experiences before, some Facebook groups and stuff, just get in contact. There's bound to be me or someone else that'll be able to help.
And
I never look down on anyone, because I've been in these positions myself. And I always remember one thing you said, Leighton, was if you get stressed, put it away and walk away from it.
Oh, definitely.
So whether that's in the dark room, developing, or even shooting, put your camera away, go talk to someone, have a laugh.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, very much so. It's very easy. It's very easy to get frustrated in the dark room, very easy, when things are just not going your way. You're just, right, that's it. I'm not doing any more today. I just walk away.
And I've definitely done that following.
Oh, yeah, I've definitely done that as well. More than once.
So we both hope you found something useful there. I hope you've enjoyed listening to Leighton and following his advice. Is there anything you need to add, Leighton?
No, not at all. Just thank you very much for listening. And you never know, I might be back on here at some point. So please keep listening to the podcast, and you know, and go and have a look at our Instagram feeds and our Facebook feeds and everything else,
which we'll link at the bottom as usual.
That's it.
So thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for joining again, Leighton. It's appreciated.
It's been absolutely been my pleasure.
And we will speak to you all again very shortly.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, folks, that's the end of another show. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I enjoyed making it. It's always great to have a guest on with me. Please do share the post and podcast show as much as you can where relevant. If you have time, please do not forget to review this on iTunes. Just hit the review button and give it 5 stars, please. It's always helpful. It's motivation for me to keep the show going, and I want to keep this going for as long as possible. And basically, I'd like to get lots of different and interesting people on here. So that's what I'm trying to do. Thank you again, and see you next time. Bye.